Microbyte. My name's Gavin Clark, software editor for The Register.
And I'm Mary Jo Foley, editor of the All About Microsoft blog.
In this show, Mike's taken a second bite at the antivirus market for consumers after the last one flopped. But what's changed? It's still the same all-in-one message as we have with Windows Live OneCare. Here's a riddle for you. When is a netbook not a netbook? Answer, when it's a low-priced value PC running Windows 7. That's according to Microsoft, at least. We'll be looking at that and on looking at how you can also expect Microsoft's pricing on Windows 7 Starter Edition to bump up the price of what, at least so far, has been a low-priced class of computing machine. And have you binged yourself? We're now a few weeks into Microsoft's new search service, its supposed latest challenger to Google. And what's the state of play in what's increasingly turning into a marathon race, not a sprint, as some of the pundits would have you believe? So, MJ, antivirus and Microsoft, you just recently wrote quite a large piece on that. You had the tip on what was going on. Tell us what's happened there, what's changed.
Sure. So here's what we know, Gavin, and up until this point, I have to say it's all been a lot of speculation about what Microsoft was going to do with this product codenamed Morrow. We knew they had this thing coming called Morrow. We knew it was a replacement for Windows Live OneCare, and that's about all we knew. Microsoft wouldn't really talk about it beyond that. But now they've basically started speaking about it. They're going to have a downloadable public beta of it for English-speaking countries plus Brazil and Israel starting on June 23rd. And so people will actually start to be able to test this and kick the tires and see what is different from Windows Live OneCare. Mm-hmm. So the little bit I know so far, not having had a chance to try the product out myself, is it's Morrow, which the final name is going to be Microsoft Security Essentials. Doesn't really roll off the tongue too well there, but MSE, as we'll call it, because it's a little easier. MSE is underneath the covers. What it is the Windows. Sorry, there's so many acronyms and so many different words in the security space for Microsoft. It's the I want to make sure I get this right. It's the forefront client engine. Right. So it's not Windows Live OneCare with just a bunch of stuff stripped off. It's really actually a different product. They took the Windows forefront client, which is their enterprise security client. They stripped off a bunch of stuff, and they made that engine the guts of what is MSE. Mm-hmm. They also, what they removed in terms of features that were also something that was included in Windows Live OneCare is a lot of the management features that were there. So you, it's not tailored for people to do some of the backup that you could do with Windows Live OneCare, some of the like printer sharing kinds of things and those functions. It's specifically an antivirus, anti-malware prevention engine. That's what it is. Right. So it's a lot lighter weight. It's smaller. It's supposedly faster and less intrusive. It's got something they're calling a cloud component, but all it is really is a digital signature update service. But they're calling that a cloud-based digital signature capability or something like that. So that's what it is underneath.
What can you tell us really where it went wrong with Windows Live OneCare? Go get this right, because they kept changing the name on that. Where did it really go wrong, and what is the supposed advantage here? I mean, from what I can see, the high-level pitch remains the same, is don't get your antivirus software from everywhere else. You can get it, everything plus your OS from Microsoft. That didn't work last time, even though a lot of people were kind of like a bit frightened at the time and thought it could disrupt the entire security and antivirus market, but that didn't happen. So what is really different this time?
Well, one thing that's really obviously different and has a lot of Microsoft's competitors really worried is this product is free. Windows Live OneCare was a subscription product that you had to buy. And that's one thing a lot of people didn't like. I remember when when OneCare came out, a lot of people felt it wasn't worth the money or that they could get a better value from some of the free antivirus and anti-malware products available on the web. And they were like, why is Microsoft, you know, a company who I feel like is putting me at security risk, charging me money for antivirus and anti-malware software. So a lot of people really objected to it on those grounds. And here they're trying to make it free. And the reason they say they're trying to make it free is to convince the kinds of users who are usually unwilling and unable to pay for antivirus and security software to use it. Mm-hmm. Because they know if somebody's PC is infected and they're part of the quote-unquote Windows ecosystem, that they are more likely to infect other people's PCs. So it's almost like they're trying to secure the perimeter with this product, and that's their main goal. I see a few problems in the strategy, though. One of them is, in order to use this new MSE product, you have to have a genuine copy of Windows, and you're going to have to go through Microsoft validation and authentication before you can download it. And as we know, a lot of the PCs in these countries that they're trying to get to adopt this are running pirated software. So it's almost like they want to secure all these PCs in these developing countries where people don't have the money to get antivirus software, but those people also don't have the money to buy real copies of Windows in some cases, and they're running pirated software.
Right.
So it's like Matt Rosoff at Directions on Microsoft said, you know, aren't they kind of shooting themselves in the foot with this, because the people are going to have a genuine copy of Windows before they can even get this antivirus software. And so a lot of people are going to try to pass that, and they'll see they can't. And so they're just not going to get the software.
Right. But I know some people might say this being of that's a very good point. I mean, it's a very North American mindset of Microsoft to kind of see the whole world as North America and assume everyone is running legal copies of Windows and wants legal copies of Windows. Obviously, there's, you know, different ways to skin a cat, as they say. So, and that's always been a problem for Microsoft. I know some of the security companies have been rattled by this in the past, and that the fact that it's free is going to upset people again. Just, do we know how it stacks up to people like Symantec, you know, and Trend Micro? How do McAfee, should they feel alarmed, A, by the technology, the prowess of it, or B, by its potential and the fact, C, that it comes for free?
You know, like I said, I haven't yet had a chance to run it myself, so I don't really know how it stacks up against those. But there are a couple of other interesting things that I think could get Microsoft in legal hot water. And I'm not saying this to encourage anybody to sue them. just want to be clear about that. But one thing that I think is somewhat alarming is, from the screenshots I've seen, when you first start up when you first start up MSE, a screen comes up and says, are you running any other antivirus or anti-malware software? And if you are, you should disable it.
Oh, that's nice of them.
Yeah. I mean, and okay, so their justification is, well, it slows down your PC if you're running multiple copies of antivirus or anti-malware. Yes, that is true, but it's pretty presumptuous to say, and you should just uninstall anybody's except ours.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that's going to cause them some problems with people like Symantec and Trend Micro.
Yeah.
And then the other question is, you know, what are PC makers going to do? Because Microsoft's saying we're open to having PC makers preload this on new PCs if they want to. Mm-hmm. But as Alan Parker, who I talked to, who's the general manager of Microsoft Anti-Malware, said, we're not really expecting them to, because a lot of PC makers make money by charging people like Symantec and Trend Micro to put trial versions of their software on new PCs.
Right.
So Microsoft's not going to charge them. They're going to let them do this for free if they want to. So they're thinking the PC makers won't do it because they're not going to get any money from Microsoft if they do.
So I have to ask, what is the point?
Well, Microsoft says the point is they just want to secure the periphery. They just want to get more people to run antivirus, anti-malware software, because those PCs that aren't are the ones infecting other people.
Yeah, but there's a, like you said, there's the issues of the countries that aren't running legitimate copies of Windows in the first place, and then there's the fact that the OEMs have a choice, and clearly they're going to go with the choice that lets them take money off of the antivirus people. It seems a very strange thing to do. I don't really understand why they should want to venture into this market once more.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be interesting to see how much pickup they get with this. They may have to adjust a lot of the things that they're thinking right now. I would think they might have to end up charging charging PC makers to preload it just to make it more competitive, you know. But they, so far that isn't the plan, they say. And or remove the genuine restriction that they have now. Although I know that they believe that by putting that restriction on there, they're keeping people safer because everyone's running non-pirated versions of software. And so again, you're at this point of, yeah, that's good in theory, but in practice, that's not really practical.
And the other part here is kind of a long-term strategy, I imagine. You know, if they're not charging for it now, you can imagine down the road they will be. I mean, first of all, you get people to like the taste of it. Then you prove it does actually secure PCs and networks, and then the OEMs like it. Then before you know it, the OEMs start getting a bill from Microsoft to install this thing on their PCs, which is probably going to undercut Trend Micro and the other guys. But yeah, free now, but paid for down the road.
Yeah, you never know, because you know, we don't know what the long-term strategy is, and a lot of things that are out there now from Microsoft and other companies, they start out as free, and the ultimate plan is to transition them to paid services over time. But when I talked to Microsoft today, they kept making the point that the reason they were making this free was because the users who they want to get to put this product on their PCs, a lot of times either don't own a credit card, and so they can't buy, you know, something like a Trend Micro or a Symantec. They can't even get it as a subscription because you have to have a credit card to do that. Or they just are unwilling to pay for it. They're like, I don't have enough, you know, disposable income, and the last thing I have to worry about is putting this on. It's like having insurance. It's like, it would be good if I had the money, but I don't, so I'm not going to.
Right. I see also that it'll uninstall Windows Defender. Is that not going to confuse things at all?
Yeah, I was a little bit confused about that myself. So the way that works is if you have Windows Defender on your machine and you load this on top, it'll automatically uninstall Defender because it already does what Defender does. But, you know, like Windows 7 is going to include Defender as a bundled piece of the operating system. So they're also leaving the market open to people who aren't going to use MSE but still might have Windows 7. And so in that case, Defender won't get uninstalled. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's complicated. It's not an easy, quick thing to understand. I think they need a quicker, easier message to be able to capture people's attention and get them to understand what they're doing here.
I mean, that, I think, is possibly the real trouble here, and the problem Microsoft really has in coming up with the technology and communicating it simply. It seems, I wonder, you know, again, organic strategies. You've got Windows Defender, now you've got Morrow, and it's like, you know, how is the ordinary end user expect to understand the difference between these? You know, they're just complicating things needlessly.
Well, I'm sitting here laughing because I'm looking at a chart that's called Offering Comparisons. Yeah. So Microsoft lists all the different ways that somebody can secure the client using Microsoft software. So it's not just MSE and Windows Live OneCare and Defender. There's also something they've got which is known called the Malicious Software Removal Tool. So that's another offering. Then they have Defender. They've got Windows Live OneCare. Then they've got Windows Live OneCare Safety Scanner, which is a whole other offering. And then they've got Forefront Client Security. So they've got 6 offerings on the client. And some of them offer anti-malware, some remove viruses, some remove spyware, some don't. You know, so you have to really like have a chart sitting there in front of you and figure out, okay, what do I need and which product is the right product and is this free? Is this a subscription? I mean, it's not something an everyday user would sit down and do, I don't think.
It's classic Microsoft product segmentation at its best. They love coming out with the flow charts and the grids that show you the features of each product SKU. But, you know, to the ordinary end user, it's completely meaningless.
Yeah. I mean, I think the key takeaway I would give somebody if they were trying to understand the difference between OneCare and MSE is they both do all the same basic things, those two products. They remove the prevalent malware. They remove most known viruses. They remove spyware. But then the difference is Windows Live OneCare included all these other things around management that MSE doesn't. So Windows Live OneCare gave you like also a managed firewall and the data backup and restore and the multi-PC management and performance tuning. Those were all built into OneCare, and they took all that stuff out of MSE because they said people didn't really need that to come from Microsoft, that they had other products and other options to do those things.
Fascinating.
So
from one riddle to another riddle, netbooks and running Windows 7 Starter Edition, that's been quite a confused story recently, hasn't it?
It has.
There's a couple of things going on here. First of all, Microsoft can't bring itself to admit that netbooks actually exist. They have to call them, I think it's like a sub laptop class of computing device. And secondly is the price, which kind of leaked out in the recent week or so. A Taiwanese publication called DigiTimes reported that the price for Windows 7 Starter Edition, which everyone pretty much expects is going to be the version of Windows 7 that goes on netbooks, is going to be about $45 to $55 a pop. Which, for those of you who are interested in these kind of Trainspotting facts, is about double what you pay for Windows XP Starter Edition, which is about $25 to $35 a machine. So that's quite a substantial increase if you're an OEM making netbooks, because suddenly Microsoft's taking a bigger bite out of your bottom line and your margins. Now, Microsoft, of course, hasn't said anything about pricing as far as it's concerned on OEM Starter Edition. It never will, because it never discloses the pricing on these things, so it says. So we're kind of working with industry reports on this. But I thought it was interesting to note that Windows Vista Starter Edition is also priced around $45 to $55, but hardly any OEMs have actually used that on netbooks. They've been using XP. So in realistic terms, Microsoft might try and square that as a flat price or no increase. But when you look at the fact most of them are using XP, that's going to be a real price hike for a lot of people.
Yeah, you know, Gavin, I got to say, I'm a little dubious on parts of that DigiTimes story because, for one, you never know when Microsoft's just floating a trial balloon. You know, sometimes they'll throw a price out there and they'll let somebody pick it up or report it, or they'll tell one OEM, this is what we're going to do. And they'll let them like run off in a panic and say, we're not going to pay that. And they're just kind of feeling the market and seeing, okay, what would they pay? You know, I mean, it sounds kind of crazy and unscientific, but I think they really do that. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, you know, DigiTimes was reporting that that $45 to $55 price and comparing that to $25 to $35. You know, what we've heard from other sources in the past is what OEMs are paying now for XP per copy is actually more like $15 a copy. And the reason Microsoft had to go so low on that price was because they needed to undercut Linux. Remember, when netbooks first came out, it was a Linux market. Linux had like 90% of the netbook market. And so what's the only thing Microsoft could do to undercut Linux, which is free? They've got to come as low as they can on the price. So $15 for a copy of Windows, that's pretty low. Because I remember back in Windows 95 days, now I'm really dating myself, but Microsoft used to be able to charge like $50 to $60 a copy to OEMs for Windows back then. So, you know, the bottom has really kind of fallen out of what they can charge, just because at least in the netbook market, they have real competition. You know, they don't really have real competition in the regular notebook and laptop market, so they can charge a lot more there because the only competition there is really Apple, and that's not huge competition for them. It's only in certain segments. So, you know, I'm a little bit dubious on those prices. I wonder if they're just kind of test prices. One thing I think people forget is they just assume if Microsoft increases a cost that the PC maker is going to pass that increased cost along to the consumer. And that's actually not a good assumption. As we've seen in the past with Windows, Microsoft traditionally has increased the price of Windows by, you know, sometimes even as much as $10 to $15 to $20 between releases, what they charge an OEM for it. And they've always justified that by saying, yeah, we're giving you a lot more features and we're putting more new stuff in, so you should pay more. And it doesn't mean that the OEMs necessarily will charge users more for the PC because they're paying more for Windows. I mean, sometimes the OEMs just have to eat that cost, and they can make up for it in other ways, either by putting more crapware on a PC or, you know, offsetting it with a lower cost component. So to just assume because Microsoft's increasing the price of Windows that it'll make the price of the machine that users have in the stores automatically be higher, that's not a safe assumption to make.
It's not normally, but I think these are unusual times. I think that the netbook market is unusual. From what I'm reading, the price of the components in the netbooks are pretty negligible in any way, and the price of the units themselves are pretty low, and they can't really take too much crapware. So I think this really is a tight market. This is the kind of market where, especially with the OEM suffering with the recession, they can't really afford to eat that cost up or pass it on. So I think we're kind of at an impasse here. And, you know, it's kind of a cliche, but you can charge $25 for Windows on a netbook, but that's still $25 more than it costs to put Linux on a netbook, and that's the kind of like hard numbers the OEMs could or should be looking at, because money talks in the business. Yep. Money is one of two things that talks in the business. The second thing that talks is process. And if you've got the processes in place to install the OS on a machine, that's fine. But sometimes you need to change those processes. So it's a matter of Linux getting into those manufacturing processes. And once it's in there, it's going to be really hard to winkle out, especially if the economics of Linux are better than the economics of Windows.
Yep. You know, the one again, another area I think is a little bit murky, because I actually wrote a piece recently on my blog saying why Windows is not a slam dunk on netbooks. And, you know, I think all these different pricing things definitely play in, and the fact that Google has Android and that there are all these new ARM netbooks that are coming out, and Microsoft said that they're not going to have Windows 7 available on ARM. Mm. When it launches, at least. So I think, you know, there's a lot of things going against Microsoft and things that could really give them a lot of problems in the netbook space. But the one thing I keep coming back to, and I'm like, this is the only thing they have an advantage in, really, is the lack of tried and true applications or services for netbooks. Yeah. And, you know, that's the one thing that they can keep saying, well, okay, if you don't want Windows, that's fine. But, yeah, you're going to have to run Google Docs. I hope you're ready to do that. And, you know, even it's a lot of users are very adventurous, and they'll say, sure, I'll try that. I don't care, you know. And other ones are like, I want to run Office, or I want to run this or that, you know. And so I think that's the only thing they really have in their favor, and they're really – strong leverage point is that there's a lot of apps for Windows, and people are familiar with Windows more than they are with Linux and Android.
Definitely. So, I think that's the last card they've got left to play, because the economics certainly won't work out for them. The question is, how long do the customers really need those Windows apps, and how long can the rivals, the open source or the Linux apps, or even, you know, the Apple or the Adobe apps, proliferate and offer an appealing proposition? Then you have to get into looking at what are people using the netbooks for? Do they need Office? Well, maybe not. Especially if we're going to get that version of Office powered by a Silverlight, the Office Lite edition, which is coming out. So suddenly,
the web apps. Yep.
So suddenly you're looking at you don't need Office on the netbook. I think this is part of my issue here in disputing the existence of the netbook market is to keep talking in terms of it being a PC market, because then Microsoft, the relevance of Microsoft and its software remains the same. The second you start questioning the reality of the PC market, it rules itself out of contention from an apps perspective on certain devices, and in this case, the netbooks.
Yeah, I totally agree with you on that too, because I'm actually really interested in getting a netbook myself. I've said that before, and the reason I am is if I really look at what I do on a PC and the way I use a PC, a lot of times all I really need to do is look at my mail, browse the web, and, you know, have some kind of an application where I can write something and post it up to the web. So I'm the really prototypical person who would be perfect for a netbook. I only need 3 apps, and I can run more if I want now since they relax that 3 application limit. But I don't really need to do, like people always say, oh, don't you need to store your music, and don't you need to play a game, and don't you need to do this? Well, on a netbook, I wouldn't need to do that. I would just use it kind of as my writing to go pad almost. And that's why I think what a lot of people would just use it for is the idea that you could use it as something that's maybe not your only machine, but it's a machine that you could use a good percentage of your time, and it would be fine. I just noticed recently on the Windows blog, Microsoft's Windows blog, they posted a Father's Day kind of guide where how you should think about netbooks if you're thinking of buying one for your dad on Father's Day. Yeah. And it was kind of interesting because, you know, Microsoft's real push and a message I think we're going to keep hearing them go back to over and over is netbooks are okay if it's your second or your third PC or just something you use as like almost a toy that's an accompaniment to your regular PC, but it's not ever going to be your only PC.
But that's a ridiculous argument for them to take because no one knows where the netbook is going to go, how fast or powerful it's going to happen. I mean, the cycle of innovation means that people are out there already working at how to cram more computing power into these devices. You know, I remember back at you, it's about Windows 95. I mean, I flash back to the laptop market back then, such as it was, and people used to categorize laptops as being for like road warriors, and they were basically like a huge slab of concrete that you pulled around. Nobody even thought you could get to the size like a MacBook Air, for example, which has much computing power. So Microsoft is just kind of like, it's like throwing out, I don't know, shapes and trying to disrupt people. I mean, that goes against the whole spirit of innovation and where this thing is going to end up. You know, I mean, sure, not now, but in the future, who knows? I mean, I heard at this Taiwanese show, Computec, they're looking at, people are coming up with stuff that you know, we're talking like more than 10-second boot times. We're talking about stuff, technology that keeps netbooks on permanently. So suddenly all the work Microsoft's done on Windows 7 to get it like really fast boot times, faster than Vista and all that stuff, suddenly that's an irrelevance. This is outdated. It is a dreadnought in the age of battleships, you know.
Yep.
Another subject, MJ, is we're a few weeks into Mike's latest challenger to Google search, Bing. What do you want to make of that?
I wasn't a fan of the name when I first heard that was going to be the final name, because you know that's one of 3 names they've been floating for the past at least 6 months. They're either going to go Hook, Bing, or Kumo, and I had kind of gotten my head around them using Kumo as the final name. When I heard Bing, I was like, wow, really? Huh. Okay. Well, Bing it. So I've been trying it out and playing around with it, and you know my first couple weeks impression is there are some things that Bing is really good for. It's really good for when you're looking for a thing, a particular thing. Like say you want to buy a camera or buy a certain pair of shoes or find a list of symptoms for a virus. It's really good at those kind of finite...
I don't know what's going on in your life right now.
It's good for those kind of really finite searches, but what it wasn't good for when I tried it was I was looking for a particular story I knew I had written, and so I put a bunch of keywords in that I knew were in the story. It could never find my story. And so, you know, Microsoft's always saying the reason a search engine is good and returns good results is because there are more and more people using it, and that Bing's results will get better as more people use it. But I can't help but wonder if this whole campaign to make Bing a decision engine and not just a search engine isn't just a marketing phrase, but that they actually want to optimize Bing for those kind of searches where you're searching for, you know, actual things you can buy or know, and not so much for things that you're just trying to find a result where you don't know exactly that it's a particular thing you're searching for.
Yeah, I think it was an interesting conceptual issue they came up with there. If you've seen the adverts on TV, they're pretty hard hitting, and they're just like a cacophony of a noise and free association of people. But to be honest, I mean, it's kind of slightly insulting because it assumes that we've all got a problem with search. Whereas, to be honest, search, whether it's Google or Yahoo, it's done the job for the last 10 years. You know, we you know, the planet has not become dislocated because of search. The recession did not happen because people couldn't search stuff. Although that is what Microsoft's trying to say with this whole decision engine kind of strategy that's coming up with. And I don't think it's really gonna stick personally. I do think you hit the right point there. They have done what Microsoft does very well, which is to create a business-oriented search engine. And I thought it was an interesting note. Somebody came out with a report a few weeks back that said how it looks like a good platform for advertisers and for businesses, which, as we know, Microsoft's got a great history of building out platforms for partners. That's what it's done with Office, and that's what it's done with Windows. This time, I think the partners are a broader category of people. They're the people putting ads online, or they're businesses that have an online presence. And so I think that's possibly where Bing has come from. They're trying to make the search engine platform more appealing to business partners.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, they've got a strategy now with this whole. They've got a term coined Microsoft Advertising, capital M, capital A, where it's basically them telling their potential advertising partners that we've got this end-to-end advertising platform. You can advertise not just through our search engine, but you can advertise inside of our games. You can advertise, in all these different subscription products that we've got coming up. So they're really trying to optimize their search to win these people over and say, okay, I want to advertise with you guys because you have all these different destinations, plus you've got a search engine that's optimized for products. And I think that 1-2 pitch is something that could actually give them at least a differentiator, if not a leg up against Google and Yahoo.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly got the properties, but I'm not sure how joined together that search strategy is. I mean, things like Xbox 360 community and Hotmail users and Office Live users. I mean, can you imagine the end-to-end advertise campaign that spans those three properties alone? And then, it's still the dynamics of the search industry are still so young. You know, I think that's more of a marketing spin than an actual technical reality.
I think the other thing is, we've seen some initial numbers. Comscore came out with data saying that the first week Bing was out, there was actually a noticeable growth in Microsoft search position. Then this week said, actually, surprisingly, the second week was really good too. But then when we saw the whole results for search query share in the month of May, Bing was still hovering around 8%. So yeah, it's doing better. It's hard to sort out, how much of that is just because of the advertising campaign Microsoft's launched now and people just kicking the tires and saying, oh, let me try it and see. What's really going to be interesting is, do people make the switch? And I haven't heard a lot of people, at least not my readers, saying, hey, I've just decided to dump Google and go Bing 100% because I think it's way better.
I think that they're in a real bind here. It's kind of an interesting parallel in that it took about 10 years for Google to build up this kind of like this search engine market share, which ironically is about the same length of time it took Microsoft to build up its lock on the desktop and set the culture and expectations around the PC using Windows and Office. So suddenly, Linux companies struggle to get onto the desktop. Now Microsoft's struggling to break the psychological lock that Google's created around internet search.
I saw around that exact same argument, I saw somebody say, though, you can't really compare, because Microsoft keeps saying, look, we came out of nowhere and we built this whole, Windows empire and it took us 10 years and we can do it in search. But the difference there was Microsoft had a lot of factors working in its favor to be the monopoly player, to grow its Windows desktops position. And in search, Google's the monopoly player, if you're going to make that parallel argument. So Microsoft's coming in as the underdog, whereas in Windows, they weren't really coming in as the underdog. they were on a much more level playing field, I think, where it had real competition at the beginning and then gradually was able to stamp out the competition. So the other thing about Bing is it's not just one central entity. They have a lot of different vertical search properties that are part of Bing. Like they've got Bing Travel, they've got Bing Health, and they've got all these sub-brands. And that whole idea of making your search engine also more vertical, not just improving the algorithm itself, but making all these different vertical pillars where you have a deeper level of expertise, that might be something that you can capitalize on too. It's a little early to say, but I've had good luck with Bing Travel. I think it's a pretty decent engine, but you know that came from their purchase of Faircast. They didn't build that from scratch themselves, so
that's what I think. I think if they've got a differentiator, it's the vertical search. Unfortunately, right now it's limited to a handful of verticals. But the benefit of Google, if there is one, it's the broadness of the search. It's kind of different search engines for different markets. Google, you can type in virtually anything, and you don't really have to care that the algorithm goes out and searches the travel market. Whereas it sounds like you'll go to Bing, and you've kind of got to know precisely what you're looking for in the case of travel. Well, okay, then the question becomes, why use Bing and why not use Orbit or something like that?
So they're trying. I'll give them that. They're trying. And man, they've got nowhere to go but up, because they've got like 8% market share. They got to try something if they're really going to stay in search.
Yeah, either that or they just like being at the bottom. Speaking of bottoms and shiny things, Steve Ballmer, the Steve Ballmer Mood Index. What do you reckon this week, MJ? I was thinking he's probably all business this week. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I think this is another one of those all business weeks. He hasn't got anything really big to crow about. He's kind of looking and watching the whole European antitrust thing, probably with a little trepidation. And, you know, Microsoft's fiscal year ends on June 30th, so this is always crunch time for them, and they've got to hustle and get the last bit of sales out that they can before the new fiscal starts. So he's probably pretty heads down right now.
Also, I think he's got a lot of personal gravity riding on the line right now. I mean, you've got the mass Bing campaign, 100 million on that. It's kind of unprecedented for Microsoft. Windows 7 Laptop Hunter campaign still running. He's gonna want to see on the Laptop Hunters, as for example, some uptick in the PC revenue business when that financial year closes. So we're talking at Q4 and Q3, and then the Bing campaign. He's hugely committed to that, and it'll be interesting to see during the next financial year how much that 100 million campaign pays off and whether he made the right call.
Yeah. And I think just to put a little plug in here for another thing on the Microsoft agenda that he's probably thinking about is Microsoft's Worldwide Partner Conference is coming up in July. And that's always a time when Ballmer has kind of a big job on his hands. He has to keep all those partners in line and keep them convinced to stay in Microsoft's camp. So I know we're going to be there, Gavin. So hopefully some of our readers will too, and we'll be able to meet up with them.
Hopefully, yeah, looking forward to meeting them. Unfortunately, we shan't be on the golf links on the Sunday afternoon where many of my partners will be. But yeah, we'll see you in the conference halls around the speaker keynotes in New Orleans in a few weeks' time. So that's Microbyte. My name's Gavin Clark, software editor for The Register.
And I'm Mary Jo Foley, editor of ZDNet's All About Microsoft blog. And thanks for listening to the latest episode of Microbyte, brought to you by the people that bite the hand that feeds IT.